Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Unlike American political parties, Behind the News adheres to its fundamental structures, which means two guests in two segments today. We'll hear from the UAW's Brandon Mencia about J.D. Vance, the GOP's alleged pro-worker turn, and then from Adam Hilton about the nature of our party system. So much of the news these days makes your head spin, which presents great challenges to those of us trying to get behind it. The reinvention of the post-shooting Donald Trump is some sort of empath. The New York Post informed me this morning that he regularly checks in with his 17-year-old granddaughter to see how her golf game is going, and some NBC News pundits spoke the other day of an unprecedentedly pensive look on his face. It's all hard to process. And then the reinvention of the Republican Party as some sort of anti-market pro-worker entity, with former hedge funder and Peter Thiel protege J.D. Vance as its new avatar, accelerates the spinning head sense. What are we to make of all this? To help us sort it all out, we're joined by Brandon Mencia, Regional Director of the United Auto Workers Region 9A, which covers Eastern New York State, New England, and Puerto Rico. Brandon got into the labor movement as a graduate student and is now the first directly elected leader of Region 9A. His family were refugees from the Guatemalan Civil War of the 1980s, and to quote his UAW bio, his commitment to building worker power comes in large part from his experience in seeing how union membership allowed his family to achieve a level of stability and job protections that working-class immigrants in non-union jobs rarely have. Apologies for the telephone audio. We had some technical difficulties with our usual setup for this one. Brandon Mencia. So a lot of people are making a big deal out of this new Republican pro-labor story. Do you buy a word of it?
No, not at all. I don't think the Republican Party and the far right or MAGA, the Trump movement, has any interest in supporting working class people to build a labor movement, fight for their rights, and to do anything else than improve the coffers of corporate America. That's their whole project. You just have to read their Project 2025 program, and it's pretty clear there that this is not a working class agenda. It's a corporate agenda masquerading as one that has working class interests.
I was just reading a piece by the journalist Zed Jelani in which he was saying the left is underestimating what a friend to the working class that J.D. Vance is. He co-sponsored a bill to lower the price of insulin. He backed legislation with Elizabeth Warren to claw back executive pay. He spearheaded legislation with Sherrod Brown to regulate the rail industry following the disaster in East Palestine. Do you think these are empty gestures? How do we respond to this?
People like J.D. Vance, they're shrewd politicians. They will make moves such as the ones that you just mentioned to appear as if they back a general working class program. They're definitely trying to defeat the Democratic Party in the progressive direction that certain members want to push the party in. They also want to de-link the labor movement from historically backing Democrats. And I think there's a left critique of that, right, of that relationship and why that's also a problem. But I think we have to be very clear that what J.D. Vance and his co-conspirators are up to is not something that's going to advance a broader agenda. I mean, I'll just tell you, J.D. Vance does not support organized labor. He does not support the PRO Act. At least he's not come out in favor of it. He has routinely criticized unions that he probably considers quote-unquote woke unions, such as Starbucks Workers United. What he has in mind is a very mythic understanding of who the working class is, which is a whole myth we've talked about for years since the Trump movement took off about the white working class. He's kind of built his entire identity and brand off of that. And while, yes, every once in a while he'll make certain policy decisions or gestures that break with our conventional understanding of the Reagan Republican, and there is a shift happening within the Republican Party, it's not one that is leading to a broader working class movement that supports broad organizing. But the game he's playing is one in which labor is brought into their opening doors to certain unions, certain union members into the Republican Party, and throwing under the bus entire segments of the working class, you know, folks of color, or trans and queer folks who are working class, and with it, a whole other set of issues that unfortunately get branded as social issues or identity issues, but they're totally not that. They are working class issues, such as the right to reproductive health care and abortion, and so many other issues that I think get this kind of cultural branding when in fact they are issues that matter to working class women, working class queer folks, and working class people broadly, period.
Now, what did you make of Sean O'Brien, the head of the Teamsters, speaking at the Republican convention the other night? And people were touting it as a really anti-corporate speech, the kind of thing you don't normally hear at a Republican convention. What did you make of what he had to say, but also what the political meaning of it is?
I get why he did this. There are parts of the speech that are not things that are usually said at a Republican national convention. It was interesting to hear him lay out what was a pretty anti-corporate agenda in his speech. I wouldn't say the rest of the Republican Party is going to pick that up necessarily for the rest of the week. It's no secret that I think the union membership as a whole, the rank and file, does not 100% line up behind one party or another. In my own union, the UAW, about 30% of our membership who voted for Trump in 2016. That number slightly decreased in 2020. I take seriously what he said, which is that he wants a bipartisan coalition that fights for the American worker. Keyword there, the American worker, right? I understand where he's coming from in the sense that he doesn't want to, quote unquote, alienate part of his base. But the part that I think doesn't quite work for me is that it still validates the worst part of our politics, whether you know you like it or not, which is that that is still a stage of the Republican Party that does not have a working class agenda and is definitely looking to undermine organized labor and workers who want the right to unionize. Any union member who thinks that Trump and the far right is a path to working class power is honestly engaging in some wishful thinking at best. And at worst, I think our unions, if they open the door to the Republican Party, are helping the billionaire class and the companies.
It does stretch one's capacity for belief to look at this Trump base in the Republican Party, provincial car dealers, small business people, and then private equity titans like Steve Schwarzman. This is not what you would look to as a sound base for working class politics.
No, absolutely. I think that's the point, right? Trumpism is not a movement based in the working class and definitely not in organized labor and the rank and file of unions. It is based in those kind of middle sectors of small owners, et cetera. And I'll tell you, for example, one of the unions we represent here in New York, Local 259, we represent the auto techs and repairmen across Long Island, New York City, and a few other states. Dealership owners are amongst the worst owners you can imagine to have to bargain with. They're the biggest union busters some of us have ever seen. They are vicious types. They hate organized labor with a passion and will do anything to create shortcuts to get around their union contracts, and we often have to strike them. To me, that is the base of Trump. The labor movement needs to think really seriously about the fact that we represent a minority of working class voters, simply because our union density is so low. It's below 10%. It's at a historic low. We're seeing the rise of interest in organizing and all that excitement and some really high-profile campaigns, but we are still not at a point that we've organized to a point that we're overcoming job losses and things of that sort. So we're still building our power at this point, and the Biden administration has been helpful in many ways to do that, but we still have a long way to go. The actual messaging that unions put out in terms of what our political program is or what a progressive program looks like, number one, there's a lot of work to actually develop that program. But secondly, we're not actually speaking to the majority of workers at this point because most workers are simply not in unions. There are millions of unorganized workers out there who do not have a political home and get their politics from right-wing news sources online or have other affinities that are guiding the way they think politically. Our political education through our established institutions right now is not going to be good enough to actually overcome those other forces. So it's an organizing problem that the labor movement has to confront.
I'm speaking with Brendan Mancia, Regional Director of UAW Region 9A. You mentioned something like 30% of the UAW membership voted for Trump. That is about 20 percentage points less than the rest of the population. But still, what do you think that they find appealing in him?
You have to remember that for a while, our union was led by leaders who had no interest in actually fighting for the membership. Many of them ended up in prison. Many of them had to be kicked out of the union. We're under federal monitorship now. And since then, we've had one member, one vote, and the election of Sean Fain. And we took on the stand-up strike and struck the three auto companies, the big three at the same time last year. And so at this point, we have dramatically changed our union a lot and have become an incredibly progressive force, a democratic force in this country. We want to organize the South. We want a Volkswagen. There's still a lot of work to be done. So we're turning it around right now. And I think as part of that comes the articulation of a progressive working class agenda, a political program that's advancing not just our members' interests, but the union movement as a whole, and also the working class as a whole, the unorganized working class at this point. So that's something we're starting to do. That work was not being done before the election of Sean Fain. At the same time, you know, we've seen decades of job losses, plant closures, concessionary contracts. And as a rank and file member, you can imagine if you're seeing your union leadership not fight for you, not organize well, agree to concessionary contracts, not fighting back against plant closures, and they're still hand in hand with the Democratic Party that also is not advancing an agenda that is directly confronting those political economic problems, then you are going to be politically just looking for an alternative. That's what that 30% is about. You know, it's a 30% rooted in finding some other path or finding another culprit for the issues that are facing them, whether it's China, whether it's offshoring to Mexico, whether it's trade policies. And honestly, you know, in a lot of ways, those members wouldn't be wrong, right? The Democrats did champion free trade policies that did immiserate their working conditions and lead to record job losses. And I think now we're starting to turn that around, but there's still a long way to go, like I said.
These new labor Republicans, these new pro-labor Republicans, like to make fun of the UAW now as being the union of graduate students and adjunct faculty and not really, you know, the horny-handed sons of toil that they used to be. How do you respond to that kind of accusation?
It's long been a union that represents a ton of different sectors. I think, obviously, the momentum right now in organized labor is really seen in sectors such as higher education. A lot of grad workers and postdoc researchers and faculty are joining the UAW in record numbers. Auto workers still make up the majority, and they are the biggest sector within the UAW. That's undeniable, and they are still, in many ways, the sector within the UAW that we represent that has the most power in this country. So, you know, when we have a stand-up strike like we did last year against the Big Three, that has national implications. That's still pretty clear. But I'll say that, you know, what we're seeing in the UAW because of the diversity of different industries and sectors and kinds of workers we represent is a really interesting project in cross-sector solidarity, a really interesting project in the formation of a class-based political program and agenda. This is really awesome to see. And in many ways, the higher ed workers are learning from some of the awesome advances in the Big Three, and just what it means to have a fighting, powerful, high-density sector, right, that was built historically since the 30s. At this point, the auto workers, especially through the organizing drives we're taking on, are also learning about what it looks like to have really disciplined, committed, member-led organizing drives. The Volkswagen election and future organizing drives are really also building off the momentum that we've built through our organizing team in higher education.
Do you think Trump is going to get anywhere with this anti-China stuff and fear-mongering around the electric car?
He's going to get away with it if we don't have a just transition, if we don't have a plan that actually is able to ensure that our membership in the traditional ICE manufacturing sector, if that transition is chaotic and leads to displacement, leads to job losses and the shuttering of towns and cities that depend on these jobs, then obviously the alternative that Trump is promoting, which is still honestly mythical, like, you know, these transitions are happening, whether he likes it or not. That's where the global economy is going. That's where different states are preparing for. And the point right now is going to be whether or not that's going to be a just transition that's going to have working class people at the center of it. We made a breakthrough in our Big Three fight last year in creating a path to that by guaranteeing that a lot of these jobs are going to be in the master agreement for those that are GM, for example, joint ventures, right, with other South Korean companies, for example. We organized Ultium Cells. We're organizing other EV companies at the moment. This transition to EV is going to come down to just whether, number one, us having the power to organizing them, and two, the political pressure to make sure that, as what happened with the Biden administration, we're not just giving handouts to these companies, but actually putting conditions on them and actually ensuring that, number one, union standards are going to be respected, and two, that unions are going to have the opportunity to actually organize these companies, and there won't be legal roadblocks put up against them. Our non-endorsement of Biden when Sean Fain took office was very much based on the fact that a lot of the money, the subsidies going to companies to start the transition, to build up these new battery plants across the country, were being done with very little consideration of labor and no conversations about what the standards and health and safety standards were going to be, the cost of living, wages, the impact of the plan on the community. And I think once we intervened in that process, we're on a path now, and we just have to keep working at it.
And finally, there's no doubt that the Republicans and their publicists are going to flog this alleged pro-labor stance and all that snake oil. What kind of strategy do you have for fighting that?
Well, I think as a labor movement, we have to be absolutely clear about what our priorities are. It would be wise of the Democratic Party to stand up to and take on that agenda. And I think that's an agenda revolving around the issues that affect working class people, union and non-union alike, equally, which is cost of living, retirement security and the complete lack thereof, honestly, and healthcare. Our union proudly stands for universal healthcare, for instance, right? We don't want a private regime of good healthcare for our members and nothing for anyone else. We want actually universal healthcare. But also that just means a progressive agenda, more broadly. I think it's, protecting the right to vote and democracy. It's restoring Roe v. Wade and also expanding Social Security and Medicare and ending medical debt and passing the PRO Act would also be essential. We also do have to do a lot more to think about just the rise of housing costs for our members and workers across the country, period. So we have to build more affordable housing. We have to invest in child care and elder care. And, of course, like I said earlier, we have to get on it with clean energy and a just transition. We have to be leaders in actually ensuring that we're not only working to create a more sustainable planet, but actually making sure that working class people have sustainable lives through that process and are not displaced by it. That's the point.
What you were just saying is a very broad pro-working class agenda, whereas I think a lot of people see unions as just protecting their little fiefdoms and not really fighting for the working class in general, but you and your union seem to be stepping out of that.
It's because for us, this is a fight for and led by the working class, period. And if there's going to be a labor movement worth fighting for, it's going to be one that's leading on all of these issues. It's still clear, I think, that we have to be clear about what our priorities are. And we need to have a program that's really based in what our members and workers as a whole are demanding. And we need to create the political home for those, for folks to come to, whether that's in our unions or, or broader in other organizations. But the point is that if we're not doing this, right, if all we're talking about is how to protect our pension plan and our contracts, then we're not serving our role. You know, our role is to obviously fight for the best contracts possible and organize more and more workers. But it's also to be the visionary leaders of what a country that is actually for and led by the working class looks like.
That was Brandon Mancia, director of UAW's Region 9A. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Son of Geld, German for money, by the early 1980s German group Melodia. Money rules the world. Our faith is our money. Not my faith, and I'm guessing not yours, but it is a distressingly popular point of view. Next, American political parties. It's been amazing to watch senior Democratic politicians trying to persuade, so far unsuccessfully, the confused and feeble Joe Biden to pack it in after having denied and or covered up the problem for months, maybe years. The spectacle made me think of Adam Hilton, whom I interviewed back in 2021, when his book True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, about its bizarre structure or lack thereof, was published. I thought the topic would be worth a revisit, especially now that the book is coming out in paper from the University of Pennsylvania Press. Since the book came out, Adam, whose day job is as assistant professor of politics at Mount Holyoke, has also been looking at the Republican Party, which used to have some more structure than the Dems, but has, over the past 8 years, become essentially Donald Trump's vehicle. Adam Hilton. Whether you read a Marxist like Gramsci or a mainstream political scientist like Schatzschneider, you see the claim that parties are central to politics. But how does that play in the U.S.? We'll talk mostly about the Democratic Party, but generally, the American party system is a real anomaly in the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is on a number of dimensions. The U.S. political party system is an outlier simply for the strictness of its two-party duopoly. There are plenty of other comparable countries like the U.K. or Canada that have two predominant parties, but nevertheless have significant minor parties that either occupy a subnational level of government or something like that. In the U.S., the strictness of its two-party system, whether it's Republicans and Democrats, or if you want to go back earlier, Whigs and Democrats, and even earlier, Federalists, Anti-Federalists, the solidness of that system has been quite profound. And it's related to another way in which American parties are so weird, which is that organizationally, they're really weak, by which we mean they're porous. They're penetrated easily. Social forces, especially organized social forces that have popular backing, that have significant resources at their command, can influence these parties to a considerable degree. And these two points, the two-partiness and the weak parties, these are related, because if you have weak parties and you are, you know, an insurgent social movement, why would you start a third party from scratch when you can just directly intervene in, try and influence, and potentially even take over one of the major parties?
Now, this unusual structure is partly traceable to the historic emergence of the American party system. In Europe, there was a restricted franchise and parties developed in that environment, where in the U.S., white men enjoyed wide access to the franchise in the 19th century. How did that explain what happened to the party structures in the two continents?
White men without property had enormous access to the vote early on, whereas in Europe, all kinds of tax and property restrictions kept the franchise quite small well into late 19th and well into the 20th century. The ultimate upshot of this is that in the United States, democracy came, in a sense, before state building. Parties could use their access to office, you know, the resources that came with controlling office, with controlling job permits, with the funds that come with access to the federal government, state governments, et cetera. And they could essentially use these to buy votes. Two major coalitions grew up around competitively trying to use the state that they controlled to rally voters to their side, outmobilize the other, and while oftentimes trying to demobilize their partisan rivals' electors.
So let's do a quick history of the Democratic Party over the last century or so. Look back at the New Deal. There was a big contradiction between the progressive reformers around FDR and the reactionary Dixiecrats. How did they navigate those contradictions at that time?
They navigated it in a few different ways. One was that there were a whole bunch of institutional arrangements that insulated Southern conservative Democrats, who were, in addition to quite obviously being virulent racists, but they were also profoundly anti-union. And those two things were linked in interesting ways. Nevertheless, they were part of the New Deal coalition. But the way that Congress worked, the way that the party worked, there were all kinds of mechanisms by which the Southern Democrats were able to exercise influence, almost veto-level control over who the party nominees would be, what kind of issues would be brought up for debate within the House or the Senate. And by these mechanisms, they were able to filter things out of the Democratic New Deal agenda that they perceived to be major threats to the Southern political economy and Jim Crow racial order. That being said, as most of your listeners will know, this was also the party of the New Deal agenda was also the party of the labor movement, especially after the mid-1930s. And these two forces within a singular coalition basically were bent on one another's destruction, especially once it was clear that the unions were going to try to move south with what at the time was called Operation Dixie, try to unionize the South. And as soon as it was clear that Southern Democrats were going to continue to veto extending aspects of the New Deal and strengthening labor unions further, you basically had a dominant electoral coalition that lasted 30 years, where the two principal players were basically at each other's throats.
This arrangement had a couple of effects. One, that the Democrats, lacking any kind of coherent party structure, came to rely on centralized executive power, right?
Yeah, that's right. Is Roosevelt and the power of the presidency as an institution that Roosevelt was so keen on building was a pretty clever way for him to get around the Democratic Party. He had initially entertained some ideas about that he could remold the Democratic Party in his image. Roosevelt tried to influence primary elections in the South to get people that were more inclined to, let's call it a progressive vision of the New Deal, to be elected to these Southern delegations, either in the House or the Senate. But those were largely failures. Yeah, Roosevelt basically abandoned his project of trying to transform the party as an organization and then just started building out the executive as a way for him to act a little bit more independently and unilaterally without those same kind of constraints on him.
Rather than being a coherent party in the European sense, it really was a federation of state parties and urban machines, right? It was not anything like a European recognize.
But no, exactly. The Democratic Party lacked what is today called the charter, but we would recognize it as a party constitution. It lacked a national structure like that. There wasn't always 50 states, but if we assume there are 50 states, there are basically 50 parties, a Democratic Party in every state. They were basically federated together, and they would meet once every 4 years in the convention. That's the sovereign body. But those people coming from those different states are not bound to one another or bound to any aggregated body that we would recognize as a national party.
And there's no sense in which people can be members of this party either. You can contribute to the Democratic National Committee and get a card or something, but you're not a member of the party in any meaningful sense.
No, there are no dues-paying members. There were at times, usually at the behest of liberal reformers, there were efforts to build these kinds of things, to create a monthly newsletter, a weekly magazine. Today, they would be doing podcasts or something like that to create more of a coherence. But these initiatives were never sustained. They were always sort of ad hoc, and they certainly did not accomplish their goals.
The contradictions that I was talking about from the 1930s between the progressive wing and the Dixiecrats persisted through the 50s, but really broke into the open in the 1960s with the Vietnam War and rising social movements. So, yeah, describe what happened during those decades.
There are a lot of moving parts to this, but to try and keep it as manageable as possible, the civil rights movement, which had enormous support, not always visible and surface level, but had, I should say, critical levels of support from the labor unions at various scales, the civil rights movement just shattered this alliance. Its days were numbered. This is not at all to say that had the civil rights movement not happened, this coalition would have been fine. The contradictions in this coalition ran really deep and were clearly festering from basically the late 30s on. But by 1964, this is exploding out into the open and often in ways that directly implicate these party structures that we were talking about before, by which Southern delegations were able to insulate themselves from the more liberal progressive wings of the party. Perhaps most famously at the 1964 convention, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was set up as a parallel party, a little bit of Leninist dual power going on down in Mississippi. They sent rival delegations to Lyndon Johnson's coronation in Atlantic City, basically pressing the contradiction to the fore by saying, Mr. President, you just signed the Civil Rights Act. Surely the position of this national party is pro-civil rights. Yet you are seating segregated all-white delegations that are coming out of what Rob Nicky calls the authoritarian enclaves of the southern United States. And basically, they challenged Lyndon Johnson and all members of the Democratic leadership to reconcile this contradiction. What are you going to do? Do you want us in the party or do you want them? That was not resolved to civil rights activist satisfaction in 64, but by 68 and then later in 1972, the party was undertaking internal reforms that mandated equal access and equal opportunity for along lines of sex, gender, race, and later sexual identity, and so on.
Yeah, everything blew up at the 68 convention, both inside and outside the convention hall, right? The riots in the streets, but also the intense conflict within the party over what direction it's going to go in. So coming out of that crisis, the party embarked on some reforms. What did those look like?
They're really remarkable. They are, historically speaking, the single greatest moment of party reform in American political history. And they are a piece of reform that I think is largely overlooked by people in liberal left circles today, even though it was almost an unparalleled victory for those forces. So those that were continuing to push civil rights into the party, those that were actively trying to get an anti-war position embraced in the party platform, and those who we would later associate with second wave feminism and even the nascent LGBTQ movement, all broke onto the scene and had influence in the backdoor negotiations that happened between the 1968 and 72 conventions that dramatically changed how delegates are selected for the convention. And I know that sounds a little in the weeds and boring, but essentially how presidents are nominated by this party.
Yeah, it went from a system in which party bosses, people in Congress, people in the state parties really selected the nominee, to one in which primary voters selected the nominee, which is a radical change.
Very radical. And there's an element of unintended consequence in here. If you go back and you look carefully at what these reformers were trying to do, they thought primaries, I think, were okay. Some of them preferred caucuses. Others were fine with primaries so long as they were married to more frequent national meetings, not just quadrennial presidential nomination, but meetings where, quote unquote, members of the party, which they wanted to sort of create as a new category, members of the party would get together to discuss strategy, platform, etc. But the way that things shook out, based on victories won and victories lost, was that we had a proliferation of primaries. It just became the easiest way for states to accommodate the new party rules by imposing the primary system that we have today. That affects not just, of course, how Democrats select their nominees, but also affects how Republicans do so.
And that reform process produced George McGovern as the nominee in 1972, who promptly got crushed by Richard Nixon. That encouraged quite the backlash against these reforms. Some of the old guard were quite explicit about not wanting to embrace a European model of the party. They didn't want a membership system. They didn't want the party discipline. They didn't want the centralization. What did they accomplish and what didn't they accomplish?
A lot of the counter-reformers, they are a group of folks who we would have in 1968 identified them all as kind of classic mainstream New Deal liberals. In retrospect, this group, or at least a significant portion of it, become what we later call neoconservatives, is they are folks who have a rather hawkish foreign policy, virulently anti-communist, which they had a big problem with the anti-war movement, as seemed to be coddling the North Vietnamese. But they had a very good record on labor unions and civil liberties, civil rights, those kinds of things. So these are folks that ended up defecting to the Republican Party over the course of the 1970s. Many of their top leaders ended up taking administrative positions in the Reagan White House and then the George W. Bush White House later on. But they were folks that were, in a sense, you know, to use the words they used, rather disgusted with the excesses of the 1960s, 1970s movements. As the quote goes from a AFL-CIO labor leader when he attended the 1972 convention, "There's too much hair and not enough cigars." At this kind of convention, there were many more women in the party. There were many more people of color. There were people that had diverse sexual identities, those kinds of things, which, you know, at the time was quite out of the mainstream. They ultimately wanted to turn back the clock. They wanted to return to a New Deal heyday that they thought could probably have been prolonged past the late 1960s, though I think we could question whether that was ever a reasonable goal. And they scored some important things. They did scuttle entirely the membership plans, the plans to remake the Democratic Party in a much more social democratic European mold. They scuttled much of the centralization plans. But they were not able to turn back the clock on how presidential nominees are selected. Those became institutionalized. And notwithstanding McGovern's wipeout defeat in 1972, the fact that Jimmy Carter used this kind of system to slip by most of the party bosses and effectively bring the Democratic Party back into the White House in 76, that probably had a lot to do with allaying some of those major fears and making a full-scale counter-revolution not just unviable, but maybe even undesirable.
I'm speaking with Adam Hilton, author of True Blues, coming out next month in paper from the University of Pennsylvania Press. But then there's the 1980 victory of Reagan, which caused yet another reaction, the Democratic Leadership Council and all that business. To most of us, that's a familiar story, Bill Clinton's and his allies' successful remaking of the Democratic Party into a more centrist organization, more business-friendly, more hawkish on foreign policy. But did those DLC reforms last, or is that just a fleeting thing?
The DLC at first, in the new democratic movement that it embodied, their first goal was to change the party organizationally. You know, they thought they could be a kind of reform force, and they could conquer the existing organizations within the Democratic Party and institutionalize their influence in ways like the McGovern reformers had done in the late 1960s. That project largely failed. They were not able to get a toehold in the party like that. So over the course of their evolution through the 1980s, they really end up shifting their strategy towards a more ideological and policy-driven accommodation with what they argued was the obvious mainstream of America being more or less Reaganite. Of course, there are lasting policy changes, for sure. Welfare reform, reforms to the financial system, of which we know the consequences after the recession. Those kinds of things obviously had lasting consequences for the party and for the nation as a whole. But you got to remember, a lot of those reforms, those key reforms, they came after the 1994 Republican Revolution, the Gingrich Revolution, in those midterm elections. And President Clinton, after signing those things, you know, he was relying on bipartisan coalitions to get those things through. There were huge numbers of congressional Democrats that were defecting. They did not go for welfare reform. They did not go for consumer finance reform. So there was a way in which this rightward turn, the neoliberalization of the Democratic Party, it had a major influence through the 90s and into the early 2000s. But looking back from even the earliest days of Barack Obama, let alone, you know, we can talk about how things look from 2021, 2022, I think it's very easy to exaggerate the Clintonite influence over the party in the 1990s. They held the leadership, and leaders are going to have enormous sway over setting the agenda and defining the image of the party. But I'm very skeptical of claims that the third way new Democrat movement were able to affect lasting change over the long term.
Okay, so now let's look at the Dems up a little more closely right now. That and the fight in particular over Biden's continued candidacy. Now, I've been thinking about the 1922 committee in Britain, the Association of Tory Backbenchers, who've told prime ministers, recently Liz Truss, most notoriously Margaret Thatcher, that it was time to go, and they did. If we had one of those, Biden would be gone, but we don't. Now, I guess we can attribute it in part to the party structure, but also the contrast between a parliamentary and a presidential system. Parliamentary system, they always have that threat of a no-confidence vote. But what are your thoughts about this? You can have the legislative branch tell the prime minister it's time to go in Britain, and here we have now, I think, 21 members of the House saying it's time for Biden to go, and nothing, you know, it's all up to him personally. What does that say about our political system?
Well, it speaks to what, you know, to use a little bit of a political science-y term, the presidentialization of our parties, is parties that have become, as our politics has become, centered around what happens in the executive. Whereas, you know, if you go back and you think about what the founders probably envisioned was more of a congressionally centered political system, since that's the only thing they had experienced before. It's a real dilemma in the sense that this is basically up to the personal whim of the president and party leader. And I think actually to quote, it was George McGovern who said, you know, to be president, you already have to be crazy to want to be. And so, you know, these are ambitious people. And this is not something, I mean, it's remarkable that someone as ambitious as Nixon or as ambitious as Lyndon Johnson left the presidency or gave it up, although the two scenarios are very different. Biden has obviously dug in. He has really dug himself in. He has been adamant. There has been no space at all for even considering departing seriously, which is an amazingly sharp contrast to the grip that Donald Trump has over his party, all of his liabilities notwithstanding. If we had a parliamentary system, this would be more straightforward. We have a decentralized democratic system. So we've got, 21 members of Congress that have stepped forward to say Biden should go. And then, of course, we have a rival delegation coming out of Hollywood led by George Clooney and others saying, it's Mr. President, it's time to go. And I think basically no matter how vocal those groups get, Biden's not going to leave.
And you mentioned Trump. This, 8 years ago, I don't think anyone would have suspected where we'd be now. There's a lot of folks saying Trump is going to tear the party apart. The old line Republican Party would not tolerate this upstart for very long. And here he is controlling the whole thing like a personal brand. How did that happen?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And I think it's one that political scientists and many others are going to be puzzling over for a long time. I'm not sure we have a comparable case in the U.S. of the degree to which a cult of personality, the domination that Trump has been able to exert over an existing major political party, it confounds in one way or another most of the existing political science theories of how parties work. To give you one example, we often think, Trump climbed to power by changing where he stood on a bunch of issues. We know that historically Trump had been pro-choice, so he became pro-life. We know that Trump had little relationship to guns, like in the sense of he did not serve in the armed forces. I'm not sure he's ever held a gun, though he has a long history of promoting law and order issues, especially about the Central Park Five and others. But he gets an endorsement from the National Rifle Association. All this seemed to fit, right? He was checking the boxes off the coalition. Okay, this group, I have their support. This group, I have their support. What we've seen in the last few years, especially since Dobbs, I think that's the key case, is Trump actually pushing back really hard on some of these groups. I mean, these groups, at least as abortion has become a little bit more of a complex issue in the post-Dobbs era, he is emphatically not for a national ban. He seems to understand completely that this is an electoral liability. He has selected a vice presidential nominee who has changed his position on this from a national ban to something a little bit more like the Trump position of just leave it to the states. And if you take a look at the party platform that's been issued for this upcoming election cycle, it probably mentions abortion as few times as, maybe the 1968 Republican Party platform did. It has become, for this party, almost a non-issue as measured by the platform. And that's not a perfect measure of where that issue stands in the party, to the extent to which it motivates its voters, or even the standing to which the pro-life movement has. But it is a dramatic departure from 2016. So this is basically a document that reads as if Trump wrote it himself, which we know he did not, because it would be probably much, much shorter. But it is a document that in almost every way reflects his personal preferences. And I don't think we've ever seen a party platform like this before.
That couldn't have happened if the party had had a more European-style structure.
No, without primary elections, and if we wanted to push this back further, without a kerfuffle and within the Democratic Party after 1968 and the reforms that were put in there, you would never get primary elections and you would never get Trump, which is not to say the 1968 reformers are responsible for Trump. But in a party system where the party organization or its backbencher equivalents or even its donors have some veto power over who is or is not going to be the nominee. In a system like that, we would have never got Trump. We might have not ever got Barack Obama, but that's not the system we have. And despite vocal opposition from basically every wing of the party, from, you know, apparent kingmakers like Fox News, or at least some of the former hosts of Fox News, or Rupert Murdoch himself, who has had a mixed relationship with Trump. All these apparent kingmakers, Trump just cut through all of them. And at least as far as the research suggests, it's because the party base was already there.
Turning back to the Democrats, recalling my last question to you 3 years ago, what is it? Is it a brand, a franchising operation? How, if it, at all, has it changed over the last few years since we last talked?
There are a lot of things that we can point to that appear to be pretty significant continuities between the Biden administration and previous Democratic administrations, or even sort of the two-party Washington consensus. We can look at Biden's commitment to Israel through the war on Gaza. We can look at his foreign policy views around the expansion of NATO. We can look at some of the privatization of Medicare and other aspects of the health system. But I think the discontinuities have been really incredible. And I would argue that while continuing to pale in comparison to the ideal of what a Democratic administration maybe could be, Biden is probably the most progressive president in modern history. Certainly as progressive, though he achieved a little less than Lyndon Johnson, more pro-labor in some ways than Franklin Roosevelt ever was, who more or less accommodated, because he had to, an alliance of convenience with the labor movement and understood transactionally what they could give him, if depending on what he gave them. Whereas here you have Biden walking the picket line, proposing the most dramatic expansion of the American healthcare system than we've ever seen. The House passed the PRO Act. The House passed the minimum wage. All these things, of course, die in the Senate because Biden did not have the numbers that you need to get legislation through a de facto supermajority Senate chamber. But it's kind of all the more dramatic that even with the razor-thin majorities he had through 2021 and 2022, that he even tried to do such an ambitious thing. I think it's fair to say, you know, you can't just declare the end of neoliberalism, as Biden effectively did when he said trickle-down economics is over, we're moving away from that. You need to do more than just declare it, right? You need to follow through with durable, substantive changes in how the political economy is structured. And he largely failed to achieve many of those. But his ambition was, at least to me, very surprising. And I think actually speaks to the relative strength of progressives in this party. Since 2016, the fact that Bernie's insurgency took so many people by surprise, the fact that Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election, which left many people scratching their heads as to, well, maybe we need to rethink how we're presenting ourselves to the electorate. And then Biden's personal decision, although he had some pretty avid advisors, that he tried to accommodate the left wing of the party to the extent that he could and bring the progressive bloc in, have continual negotiations with them, put Bernie in a position of significant authority inside the Senate on the budget committee. These things, you know, they didn't achieve what I think maybe they could have under other circumstances. But this is a Democratic Party coalition that is itself changing, although you wouldn't know it by looking at the octogenarian who is leading that party.
Well, he's not the only geezer at the top of the party, though. It's really a very aged leadership that seems sometimes to reflect atherosclerosis of the party.
Yeah, but, in just the same way, Doug, given that aged leadership, you know, in 10 years, they're all going to be gone, is we're going to have significant turnover in the Democratic Party leadership over the next cycle or two. All these people, whether by natural causes or just by retirement from professional life, they will be gone from the scene. Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Barack Obama will be around for a while, presumably. But, you know, the rest of them will all be, I mean, even Bernie, I'm sorry to say, they're going to be gone soon. That's going to be a Democratic Party leadership. That's going to be an opportunity for the leadership to come more into line with what the party looks like at the sub-leadership level.
I have to say, though, that Biden's handling of Gaza has really damaged his reputation with progressives.
Oh, terribly. Terribly. Even though I would posit that he acted exactly how you'd expect any American president to act in such a crisis.
Yeah, but this is one area where the change among the younger members of the party is fairly dramatic, that they've lost patience with that traditional relationship with Israel.
It is profound. And Gen Z plus millennials, plus maybe some progressive Gen Xers, they will be the majority of the activist core of the Democratic Party pretty soon.
Well, of course, if Trump wins, which seems not unlikely at this point, the effects of the Democratic Party would be hard to prognosticate.
You know, I agree. And a big part of my book is that, you know, elections produce winners and losers, not just between the parties, but within them. Because every nomination, there's always risk involved in that. And there's always some prediction, calculation, some prognostication about, well, what's going to work and what isn't. And so when those things fail, like it did in 2016 for the Democrats, there's always a bunch of head scratching, relitigating, debate over the subsequent year or so following that. And, you know, what's been remarkable to me about the debate over the last few weeks and the degree to which it is so focused on Biden and his age rather than his policy positions or his efforts to go big and go bold or his middle out economic agenda. None of that is really on the table for is this where we're erring or was this a bad idea, that kind of thing. So there is a future that I think is not implausible where Trump wins this election and Democrats go back to the drawing board and they say, we can never nominate an elderly old white man again. What we wouldn't probably hear are the latter day centrists and the, you know, those that continue to exist from the old Bill Clinton coalition writing in the New York Times an opinion piece that says Biden lost because he was too progressive. That's the kind of thing I think we won't get.
I was Adam Hilton, assistant professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College and author of True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, which is coming out in paper from the University of Pennsylvania Press in August. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Money, Success, Fame, Glamour by Felix the House Cat. Again, not my point of view, but we contain multitudes. Till next week, bye.